Sir Leicester receives that ferruginous person graciously.
"I hope you are well, Mr. Rouncewell. Be seated. My solicitor, Mr. Tulkinghorn. My lady was desirous, Mr. Rouncewell," Sir Leicester skilfully transfers him with a solemn wave of his hand, "was desirous to speak with you. Ahem." "I shall be very happy," returns the iron gentleman, "to give my best attention to anything Lady Dedlock does me the honour to say." As he turns towards her, he finds that the impression she makes upon him is less agreeable than on the former occasion. A distant, supercilious air makes a cold atmosphere about her, and there is nothing in her bearing, as there was before, to encourage openness.
"Pray, sir," says Lady Dedlock listlessly, "may I be allowed to inquire whether anything has passed between you and your son, respecting your son's fancy?"
It is almost too troublesome to her languid eyes to bestow a look upon him as she asks this question.
"If my memory serves me, Lady Dedlock, I said when I had the pleasure of seeing you before, that I should seriously advise my son to conquer that fancy."
The ironmaster repeats her expression with a little emphasis.
"And did you?"
"Oh, of course I did."
Sir Leicester gives a nod, approving and confirmatory. Very proper. The iron gentleman, having said that he would do it, was bound to do it. No difference in this respect between the base metals and the precious. Highly proper.
"And pray, has he done so?"
"Really, Lady Dedlock, I cannot make you a definite reply. I fear not. Probably not yet. In our condition of life, we sometimes couple an intention with our fancies, which renders them not altogether easy to throw off. I think it is rather our way to be in earnest."
Sir Leicester has a misgiving that there may be a hidden Wat Tylerish meaning in this expression, and fumes a little. Mr. Rouncewell is perfectly good-humoured and polite, but within such limits, evidently adapts his tone to his reception.
"Because," proceeds my lady, "I have been thinking of the subject, which is tiresome to me."
"I am very sorry, I'm sure."
"And also of what Sir Leicester said upon it, in which I quite concur,"
Sir Leicester flattered.
"And if you cannot give us the assurance that this fancy is at an end, I have come to the conclusion that the girl had better leave me."
"I can give no such assurance, Lady Dedlock. Nothing of the kind."
"Then she had better go."
"Excuse me, my lady," Sir Leicester considerately interposes. "Perhaps this may be doing an injury to the young woman which she has not merited. Here is a young woman," says Sir Leicester,
magnificently laying out the matter with his right hand like a service of plate,
"whose good fortune it is to have attracted the notice and favour of an eminent lady, and to live under the protection of that eminent lady, surrounded by the various advantages which such a position confers, and which are unquestionably very great, I believe unquestionably very great, sir, for a young woman in that station of life. The question then arises, should that young woman be deprived of these many advantages and that good fortune, simply because she has—"
Sir Leicester, with an apologetic but dignified inclination of his head towards the ironmaster, winds up his sentence,
"has attracted the notice of Mr. Rouncewell's son. Now, has she deserved this punishment? Is this just towards her? Is this our previous understanding?"
"I beg your pardon," interposes Mr. Rouncewell's son's father.
"Sir Leicester, will you allow me? I think I may shorten the subject. Pray dismiss that from your consideration. If you remember anything so unimportant, which is not to be expected, you would recollect that my first thought in the affair was directly opposed to her remaining here."
"Dismiss the Dedlock patronage from consideration."
"Oh!"
Sir Leicester is bound to believe a pair of ears that have been handed down to him through such a family, or he really might have mistrusted their report of the iron gentleman's observations.
"It is not necessary,"
observes my lady in her coldest manner before he can do anything but breathe amazedly, "to enter into these matters on either side. The girl is a very good girl. I have nothing whatever to say against her. But she is so far insensible to her many advantages and her good fortune that she is in love, or supposes she is, poor little fool, and unable to appreciate them." Sir Leicester begs to observe that wholly alters the case. He might have been sure that my lady had the best grounds and reasons in support of her view. He entirely agrees with my lady. The young woman had better go.
"As Sir Leicester observed, Mr. Rouncewell, on the last occasion when we were fatigued by this business,"
Lady Dedlock languidly proceeds. "We cannot make conditions with you. Without conditions and under present circumstances, the girl is quite misplaced here and had better go. I have told her so. Would you wish to have her sent back to the village, or would you like to take her with you, or what would you prefer?"
"Lady Dedlock, if I may speak plainly—"
"By all means.
I should prefer the course which will the soonest relieve you of the encumbrance and remove her from her present position."
"And to speak as plainly—"
she returns with the same studied carelessness.
"So should I. Do I understand that you will take her with you?"
The iron gentleman makes an iron bow.
"Sir Leicester, will you ring?"
Mr. Tulkinghorn steps forward from his window and pulls the bell.
"I had forgotten you. Thank you."
He makes his usual bow and goes quietly back again. Mercury, swift responsive, appears, receives instructions whom to produce, skims away, produces the aforesaid, and departs. Rosa has been crying and is yet in distress. On her coming in, the ironmaster leaves his chair, takes her arm in his, and remains with her near the door, ready to depart.
"You are taken charge of, you see," says my lady in her weary manner, "and are going away well protected. I have mentioned that you are a very good girl, and you have nothing to cry for."
"She seems, after all," observes Mr. Tulkinghorn, loitering a little forward with his hands behind him, "as if she were crying at going away."
"Why, she's not well-bred, you see,"
returns Mr. Rouncewell with some quickness in his manner, as if he were glad to have the lawyer to retort upon, "and she is an inexperienced little thing and knows no better. If she had remained here, sir, she would have improved, no doubt."
"No doubt,"
is Mr. Tulkinghorn's composed reply. Rosa sobs out that she is very sorry to leave my lady, and that she was happy at Chesney Wold, and has been happy with my lady, and that she thanks my lady over and over again.
"Out, you silly little puss,"
says the ironmaster, checking her in a low voice, though not angrily.
"Have a spirit, if you're fond of what."
My lady merely waves her off with indifference, saying,
"There, there, child, you're a good girl. Go away."
Sir Leicester has magnificently disengaged himself from the subject, and retired into the sanctuary of his blue coat. Mr. Tulkinghorn, an indistinct form against the dark street, now dotted with lamps, looms in my lady's view bigger and blacker than before. "Sir Leicester and Lady Dedlock," says Mr. Rouncewell, after a pause of a few moments, "I beg to take my leave, with an apology for having again troubled you, though not of my own act, on this tiresome subject. I can very well understand, I assure you, how tiresome so small a matter must have become to Lady Dedlock. If I am doubtful of my dealing with it, it is only because I did not at first quietly exert my influence to take my young friend here away without troubling you at all. But it appeared to me, I dare say magnifying the importance of the thing, that it was respectful to explain to you how the matter stood, and candid to consult your wishes and convenience. Now I hope you will excuse my want of acquaintance with the polite world." Sir Leicester considers himself evoked out of the sanctuary by these remarks.
"Mr. Rouncewell," he returns, "do not mention it. Justifications are unnecessary, I hope, on either side."
"I'm glad to hear it, Sir Leicester, and if I may, by way of a last word, revert to what I said before of my mother's long connection with the family, and the worth it bespeaks on both sides, I would point out this little instance here on my arm, who shows herself so affectionate and faithful in parting, and in whom my mother, I dare say, has done something to awaken such feelings. Though, of course, Lady Dedlock, by her heartfelt interest and her genial condescension, has done much more." If he mean this ironically, it may be truer than he thinks. He points it, however, by no deviation from his straightforward manner of speech, though in saying it he turns towards that part of the dim room where my lady sits. Sir Leicester stands to return his parting salutation. Mr. Tulkinghorn again rings. Mercury takes another flight, and Mr. Rouncewell and Rosa leave the house. Then lights are brought in, discovering Mr. Tulkinghorn still standing in his window with his hands behind him, and my lady still sitting with his figure before her, closing up her view of the night as well as of the day. She is very pale. Mr. Tulkinghorn, observing it as she rises to retire, thinks, "Well, she may be. The power of this woman is astonishing. She has been acting a part the whole time." But he can act a part, too, his one unchanging character, and as he holds the door open for this woman, 50 pairs of eyes, each 50 times sharper than Sir Leicester's pair, should find no flaw in him. Lady Dedlock dines alone in her own room today. Sir Leicester is whipped into the rescue of the Doodle party and the discomfiture of the Coodle faction. Lady Dedlock asks on sitting down to dinner, still deadly pale, and quite an illustration of the debilitated cousin's text, whether he has gone out. Yes. Whether Mr. Tulkinghorn is gone yet. No. Presently she asks again, is he gone yet? No. What is he doing? Mercury thinks he is writing letters in the library. Would my lady wish to see him? Anything but that. But he wishes to see my lady. Within a few more minutes he is reported as sending his respects, and could my lady please to receive him for a word or two after her dinner? My lady will receive him now. He comes now, apologizing for intruding, even by her permission, while she is at table. When they are alone, my lady waves her hand to dispense with such mockeries. What do you want, sir? Why, Lady Dedlock, says the lawyer, taking a chair at a little distance from her and slowly rubbing his rusty legs up and down, up and down, up and down. I am rather surprised by the course you have taken.
Indeed?
Yes, decidedly. I was not prepared for it. I consider it a departure from our agreement and your promise. It puts us in a new position, Lady Dedlock. I feel myself under the necessity of saying that I don't approve of it. He stops in his rubbing and looks at her, with his hands on his knees. Imperturbable and unchangeable as he is, there is still an indefinable freedom in his manner which is new and which does not escape this woman's observation.
I do not quite understand you.
Oh, yes, you do, I think. I think you do. Come, come, Lady Dedlock. We must not fence and parry now. You know you like this girl.
Well, sir?
And you know, and I know, that you have not sent her away for the reasons you have assigned, but for the purpose of separating her as much as possible from—excuse my mentioning it as a matter of business—any reproach and exposure that impend over yourself.
Well, sir?
Well, Lady Dedlock, returns the lawyer, crossing his legs and nursing the uppermost knee. I object to that. I consider that a dangerous proceeding. I know it to be unnecessary and calculated to awaken speculation, doubt, rumour, I don't know what, in the house. Besides, it is a violation of our agreement. You were to be exactly what you were before, whereas it must be evident to yourself, as it is to me, that you have been this evening very different from what you were before. Why, bless my soul, Lady Dedlock, transparently so.
If, sir, she begins, in my knowledge of my secret—
But he interrupts her. Now, Lady Dedlock, this is a matter of business. And in a matter of business the ground cannot be kept too clear. It is no longer your secret. Excuse me. That is just a mistake. It is my secret. In trust for Sir Leicester and the family. If it were your secret, Lady Dedlock, we should not be here holding this conversation.
That is very true. If in my knowledge of the secret, I do what I can to spare an innocent girl, especially remembering your own reference to her when you told my story to the assembled guests at Chesney Wold, from the taint of my impending shame, I act upon a resolution I have taken. Nothing in the world and no one in the world could shake it or could move me.
This she says with great deliberation and distinctness, and with no more outward passion than himself. As for him, he methodically discusses his matter of business as if she were any insensible instrument used in business.
Really?
Then you see, Lady Dedlock, he returns, you are not to be trusted. You have put the case in a perfectly plain way, and according to the literal fact, and that being the case, you are not to be trusted.
Perhaps you may remember that I expressed some anxiety on this same point when we spoke at night at Chesney Wold.
Yes, says Mr. Tulkinghorn, coolly getting up and standing on the hearth. Yes, I recollect, Lady Dedlock, that you certainly referred to the girl, but that was before we came to our arrangement, and both the letter and the spirit of our arrangement altogether precluded any action on your part founded upon my discovery. There can be no doubt about that. As to sparing the girl, of what importance or value is she? Spare.
Lady Dedlock, here is a family name compromised. One might have supposed that the course was straight on, over everything, neither to the right nor to the left, regardless of all considerations in the way, sparing nothing, treading everything underfoot. She has been looking at the table. She lifts up her eyes and looks at him. There is a stern expression on her face, and a part of her lower lip is compressed under her teeth. "This woman understands me," Mr. Tulkinghorn thinks as she lets her glance fall again. "She cannot be spared. Why should she spare others?" For a little while they are silent. Lady Dedlock has eaten no dinner, but has twice or thrice poured out water with a steady hand and drunk it. She rises from table, takes a lounging chair, and reclines in it, shading her face. There is nothing in her manner to express weakness or excite compassion. It is thoughtful, gloomy, concentrated. "This woman," thinks Mr. Tulkinghorn, standing on the hearth, again a dark object closing up her view, "is a study." He studies her at his leisure, not speaking for a time. She, too, studies something at her leisure. She is not the first to speak, appearing indeed so unlikely to be so, though he stood there until midnight, that even he is driven upon breaking silence. "Lady Dedlock, the most disagreeable part of this business interview remains, but it is business. Our agreement is broken. A lady of your sense and strength of character will be prepared for my now declaring it void and taking my own course."
"I am quite prepared."
Mr. Tulkinghorn inclines his head. "That is all I have to trouble you with, Lady Dedlock." She stops him as he is moving out of the room by asking,
"This is the notice I was to receive?
I wish not to misapprehend you." "Not exactly the notice you were to receive, Lady Dedlock, because the contemplated notice supposed the agreement to have been observed, but virtually the same, virtually the same. The difference is merely in a lawyer's mind."
"You intend to give me no other notice?"
"You are right, no."
"Do you contemplate undeceiving Sir Leicester tonight?"
"A home question," says Mr. Tulkinghorn, with a slight smile and cautiously shaking his head at the shaded face. "No, not tonight."
"Tomorrow?"
"All things considered, I had better decline answering that question, Lady Dedlock. If I were to say I don't know when exactly, you would not believe me, and it would answer no purpose. It may be tomorrow. I would rather say no more. You are prepared, and I hold out no expectations, which circumstances might fail to justify. I wish you good evening." She removes her hand, turns her pale face towards him as he walks silently to the door, and stops him once again as he is about to open it.
"Do you intend to remain in the house any time? I heard you were writing in the library. Are you going to return there?"
"Only for my hat. I am going home." She bows her eyes rather than her head, the movement is so slight and curious, and he withdraws. Clear of the room, he looks at his watch, but is inclined to doubt it by a minute or thereabouts. There is a splendid clock upon the staircase, famous, as splendid clocks not often are, for its accuracy. "And what do you say?" Mr. Tulkinghorn inquires, referring to it. "What do you say?" If it said now, "Don't go home," what a famous clock hereafter, if it said, "Tonight of all the nights that it has counted off, to this old man of all the young and old men who have ever stood before it, don't go home." With its sharp, clear bell, it strikes 7:15 and ticks on again. "Why, you are worse than I thought you," says Mr. Tulkinghorn, muttering reproof to his watch. 2 minutes wrong? At this rate you won't last my time." What a watch to return good for evil if it ticked in answer, "Don't go home." He passes out into the streets and walks on, with his hands behind him, under the shadow of the lofty houses, many of whose mysteries, difficulties, mortgages, delicate affairs of all kinds, are treasured up within his old black satin waistcoat. He is in the confidence of the very bricks and mortar. The high chimney stacks telegraph family secrets to him, yet there is not a voice in a mile of them to whisper, "Don't go home." Through the stir and motion of the commoner streets, through the roar and jar of many vehicles, many feet, many voices, with the blazing shop lights lighting him on, the west wind blowing him on, and the crowd pressing him on, he is pitilessly urged upon his way, and nothing meets him, murmuring, "Don't go home." arrived at last in his dull room to light his candles and look round and up and see the Roman pointing from the ceiling. There is no new significance in the Roman's hand to-night, or in the flutter of the attendant groups, to give him the late warning, "Don't come here." It is a moonlight night, but the moon, being past the full, is only now rising over the great wilderness of London. The stars are shining as they shone above the turret leads at Chesney Wold. This woman, as he has of late been so accustomed to call her, looks out upon them. Her soul is turbulent within her. She is sick at heart and restless. The large rooms are too cramped and close. She cannot endure their restraint and will walk alone in a neighbouring garden. Too capricious and imperious in all she does to be the cause of much surprise in those about her as to anything she does, this woman, loosely muffled, goes out into the moonlight. Mercury attends with the key. Having opened the garden gate, he delivers the key into his lady's hands at her request and is bidden to go back. She will walk there some time to ease her aching head. She may be an hour, she may be more, she needs no further escort. The gate shuts upon its spring with a clash, and he leaves her passing on into the dark shade of some trees. A fine night, and a bright, large moon, and multitudes of stars. Mr. Tulkinghorn, in repairing to his cellar, and in opening and shutting those resounding doors, has to cross a little prison-like yard. He looks up casually, thinking what a fine night, what a bright, large moon, what multitudes of stars. A very quiet night, too. A very quiet night. When the moon shines very brilliantly, a solitude and stillness seem to proceed from her that influence even crowded places full of life. Not only is it a still night on dusty high roads and on hill summits, whence a wide expanse of country may be seen in repose, quieter and quieter as it spreads away into a fringe of trees against the sky with the grey ghost of a bloom upon them. Not only is it a still night in gardens and in woods, and on the river where the water meadows are fresh and green, and the stream sparkles on among pleasant islands, murmuring weirs and whispering rushes. Not only does the stillness attend it as it flows where houses cluster thick, where many bridges are reflected in it, where wharves and shipping make it black and awful, where it winds from these disfigurements through marshes whose grim beacons stand like skeletons washed ashore, where it expands through the boulder region of rising grounds, rich in cornfield, windmill and steeple, and where it mingles with the ever-heaving sea. Not only is it a still night on the deep, and on the shore where the watcher stands to see the ship with her spread wings cross the path of light that appears to be presented to only him. But even on this stranger's wilderness of London there is some rest. Its steeples and towers and its one great dome grow more ethereal. Its smoky housetops lose their grossness in the pale effulgence. The noises that arise from the streets are fewer and are softened, and the footsteps on the pavements pass more tranquilly away. In these fields of Mr. Tulkinghorn's inhabiting, where the shepherds play on chancery pipes that have no stop, and keep their sheep in the fold by hook and by crook, until they have shorn them exceeding close, every noise is merged, this moonlight night, into a distant, ringing hum, as if the city were a vast glass vibrating. What's that? Who fired a gun or pistol? Where was it? The few foot passengers start, stop, and stare about them. Some windows and doors are opened, and people come out to look. It was a loud report, and echoed and rattled heavily. It shook one house, or so a man says, who was passing. It has aroused all the dogs in the neighbourhood, who bark vehemently. Terrified cats scamper across the road. While the dogs are yet barking and howling, there is one dog howling like a demon. The church clocks, as if they were startled, too, begin to strike. The hum from the streets, likewise, seems to swell into a shout. But it is soon over. Before the last clock begins to strike 10, there is a lull. When it has ceased, the fine night, the bright large moon, and multitudes of stars are left at peace again. Has Mr. Tulkinghorn been disturbed? His windows are dark and quiet, and his door is shut. It must be something unusual indeed to bring him out of his shell. Nothing is heard of him. Nothing is seen of him. What power of cannon might it take to shake that rusty old man out of his immovable composure? For many years the persistent Roman has been pointing, with no particular meaning, from that ceiling. It is not likely that he has any new meaning in him tonight. Once pointing, always pointing, like any Roman or even Briton, with a single idea. There he is, no doubt, in his impossible attitude, pointing unavailingly all night long. Moonlight, darkness, dawn, sunrise, day. There he is still, eagerly pointing, and no one minds him. But a little after the coming of the day come people to clean the rooms, and either the Roman has some new meaning in him, not expressed before, or the foremost of them goes wild, for looking up at his outstretched hand and looking down at what is below it, that person shrieks and flies. The others, looking in as the first one looked, shriek and fly too, and there is an alarm in the street. What does it mean? No light is admitted into the darkened chamber, and people unaccustomed to it enter, and treading softly but heavily, carry a weight into the bedroom and lay it down. There is whispering and wondering all day, strict search of every corner, careful tracing of steps, and careful noting of the disposition of every article of furniture. All eyes look up at the Roman, and all voices murmur, if he could only tell what he saw. He is pointing at a table, with a bottle, nearly full of wine, and a glass upon it, and two candles that were blown out suddenly, soon after being lighted. He is pointing at an empty chair, and a stain upon the ground before it that might be almost covered with a hand. These objects lie directly within his range. An excited imagination might suppose that there was something in them so terrific as to drive the rest of the composition, not only the attendant big-legged boys, but the clouds and flowers and pillars too, in short, the very body and soul of allegory and all the brains it has, stark mad. It happens, surely, that everyone who comes into the darkened room and looks at these things looks up at the Roman, and that he is invested in all eyes with mystery and awe, as if he were a paralyzed, dumb witness. So it shall happen, surely, through many years to come, that ghostly stories shall be told of the stain upon the floor, so easy to be covered, so hard to be got out, and that the Roman, pointing from the ceiling, shall point, so long as dust and damp and spiders spare him, with far greater significance than he ever had in Mr. Tulkinghorn's time, and with a deadly meaning. For Mr. Tulkinghorn's time is over for evermore. And the Roman pointed at the murderous hand uplifted against his life, and pointed helplessly at him from night to morning, lying face downward on the floor, shot through the heart. Chapter 49. Dutiful Friendship. A great annual occasion has come round in the establishment of Mr. Matthew Bagnet, otherwise Lignum Vitae, ex-artilleryman and present bassoon player, an occasion of feasting and festival, the celebration of a birthday in the family. It is not Mr. Bagnet's birthday. Mr. Bagnet merely distinguishes that epoch in the musical instrument business by kissing the children with an extra smack before breakfast, smoking an additional pipe after dinner, and wondering towards evening what his poor old mother is thinking about it, a subject of infinite speculation, and rendered so by his mother having departed this life 20 years. Some men rarely revert to their father, but seem, in the bank books of their remembrance, to have transferred all the stock of filial affection into their mother's name. It is not the birthday of one of the three children. Those occasions are kept with some marks of distinction, but they rarely overleap the bounds of happy returns and a pudding. On young Woolwich's last birthday, Mr. Bagnet certainly did, after observing on his growth and general advancement, proceed, in a moment of profound reflection on the changes wrought by time, to examine him in the catechism, accomplishing with extreme accuracy the questions number 1 and 2,
"What is your name?" and "Who gave you that name?"
But there, failing in the exact precision of his memory and substituting for number 3 the question,
"And how do you like that name?"
which he propounded with a sense of its importance, in itself so edifying and improving as to give it quite an orthodox air. This, however, was a speciality of that particular birthday, and not a general solemnity. It is the old girl's birthday, and that is the greatest holiday and reddest letter day in Mr. Bagnet's calendar. The auspicious event is always commemorated according to certain forms settled and prescribed by Mr. Bagnet some years since. Mr. Bagnet, being deeply convinced that to have a pair of fowls for dinner is to attain the highest pitch of imperial luxury,
invariably goes forth himself very early in the morning of this day to buy a pair. He is as invariably taken in by the vendor, and installed in the possession of the oldest inhabitants of any coop in Europe. Returning with these triumphs of toughness, tied up in a clean blue and white cotton handkerchief, essential to the arrangements, he in a casual manner invites Mrs. Bagnet to declare at breakfast what she would like for dinner. Mrs. Bagnet, by a coincidence never known to fail, replying fowls, Mr. Bagnet instantly produces his bundle from a place of concealment amidst general amazement and rejoicing. He further requires that the old girl shall do nothing all day long but sit in her very best gown and be served by himself and the young people. As he is not illustrious for his cookery, this may be supposed to be a matter of state rather than enjoyment on the old girl's part, but she keeps her state with all imaginable cheerfulness. On this present birthday, Mr. Bagnet has accomplished the usual preliminaries. He has bought 2 specimens of poultry, which, if there be any truth in adages, were certainly not caught with chaff, to be prepared for the spit. He has amazed and rejoiced the family by their unlooked-for production. He is himself directing the roasting of the poultry, and Mrs. Bagnet, with her wholesome brown fingers itching to prevent what she sees going wrong, sits in her gown of ceremony an honoured guest. Quebec and Malta lay the cloth for dinner, while Woolwich, serving as beseems him under his father, keeps the fowls revolving. To these young scullions Mrs. Bagnet occasionally imparts a wink or a shake of the head, or a crooked face as they made mistakes.
"At 1:30, says Mr. Bagnet, to the minute they'll be done."
Mrs. Bagnet, with anguish, beholds one of them at a standstill before the fire, and beginning to burn.
"You shall have a dinner, old girl," says Mr. Bagnet, "fit for a queen."
Mrs. Bagnet shows her white teeth cheerfully, but to the perception of her son betrays so much uneasiness of spirit that he is impelled by the dictates of affection to ask her, with his eyes, what is the matter, thus standing, with his eyes wide open, more oblivious of the fowls than before, and not affording the least hope of a return to consciousness. Fortunately, his elder sister perceives the cause of the agitation in Mrs. Bagnet's breast, and with an admonitory poke recalls him. The stopped fowls, going round again, Mrs. Bagnet closes her eyes in the intensity of her relief.
"George will look us up," says Mr. Bagnet, "at 4:30, to the moment. How many years, old girl, has George looked us up this afternoon?"
"Oh, lignum, lignum, as many as make an old woman of a young one, I begin to think. Just about that, and no less,"
returns Mrs. Bagnet, laughing and shaking her head.
"Old girl," says Mr. Bagnet, "never mind. You'd be as young as ever you was, if you wasn't younger, which you are, as everybody knows."
Quebec and Malta here exclaim with clapping of hands that Bluffy is sure to bring Mother something, and begin to speculate on what it will be.
"Do you know, Lignum,"
says Mrs. Bagnet, casting a glance on the tablecloth and winking salt at Malta with her right eye, and shaking the pepper away from Quebec with her head,
"I begin to think George is in the roving way again."
"George," returns Mr. Bagnet, "will never desert, and leave his old comrade in the lurch. Don't be afraid of it."
"No, Lignum, no, I don't say he will. I don't think he will. But if he could get over this money trouble of his, I believe he would be off."
Mr. Bagnet asks why.
"Well," returns his wife, considering, "George seems to me to be getting not a little impatient and restless. I don't say but what he's as free as ever. Of course he must be free, or he wouldn't be George, but he smarts and seems put out." "He's extra drilled," says Mr. Bagnet, "by a lawyer who would put the devil out."
"There's something in that," his wife assents, "but so it is, Lignum."
Further conversation is prevented, for the time, by the necessity under which Mr. Bagnet finds himself of directing the whole force of his mind to the dinner, which is a little endangered by the dry humour of the fowls in not yielding any gravy, and also by the made gravy acquiring no flavour and turning out of a flaxen complexion. With a similar perverseness, the potatoes crumble off forks in the process of peeling, upheaving from their centres in every direction as if they were subject to earthquakes. The legs of the fowls, too, are longer than could be desired, and extremely scaly. Overcoming these disadvantages to the best of his ability, Mr. Bagnet at last dishes, and they sit down at table, Mrs. Bagnet occupying the guest's place at his right hand. It is well for the old girl that she has but one birthday in a year.
for two such indulgences in poultry might be injurious. Every kind of finer tendon and ligament that is in the nature of poultry to possess is developed in these specimens in the singular form of guitar strings. Their limbs appear to have struck roots into their breasts and bodies, as aged trees strike roots into the earth. Their legs are so hard as to encourage the idea that they must have devoted the greater part of their long and arduous lives to pedestrian exercises and the walking of matches. But Mr. Bagnet, unconscious of these little defects, sets his heart on Mrs. Bagnet eating a most severe quantity of the delicacies before her. And as that good old girl would not cause him a moment's disappointment on any day, least of all on such a day, for any consideration, she imperils her digestion fearfully. How young Woolwich cleans the drumsticks without being of ostrich descent, his anxious mother is at a loss to understand. The old girl has another trial to undergo after the conclusion of the repast, in sitting in state to see the room clear, the hearth swept, and the dinner service washed up and polished in the backyard. The great delight and energy with which the two young ladies apply themselves to these duties, turning up their skirts in imitation of their mother and skating in and out on little scaffolds of patterns, inspire the highest hopes for the future, but some anxiety for the present. The same causes lead to confusion of tongues, a clattering of crockery, a rattling of tin mugs, a whisking of brooms, and an expenditure of water all in excess, while the saturation of the young ladies themselves is almost too moving a spectacle for Mrs. Bagnet to look upon with a calmness proper to her position. At last, the various cleansing processes are triumphantly completed. Quebec and Malta appear in fresh attire, smiling and dry. Pipes, tobacco, and something to drink are placed upon the table, and the old girl enjoys the first peace of mind she ever knows on the day of this delightful entertainment. When Mr. Bagnet takes his usual seat, the hands of the clock are very near to 4:30. As they mark it accurately, Mr. Bagnet announces,
"George, military time."
It is George, and he has hearty congratulations for the old girl, whom he kisses on the great occasion, and for the children, and for Mr. Bagnet.
"Happy returns to all!" says Mr. George.
"But George, old man," cries Mrs. Bagnet, looking at him curiously, "what's come to you?"
"Come to me!"
"Ah, oh, you're so white, George, for you, and look so shocked. Now don't he, Lignum?"
"George," says Mr. Bagnet, "tell the old girl what's the matter."
"I didn't know I looked white,"
says the trooper, passing his hand over his brow.
"But I didn't know I looked shocked, and I'm sorry I do. But the truth is, that boy who was taken in at my place died yesterday afternoon, and it has rather knocked me over."
"Poor creature," says Mrs. Bagnet, with a mother's pity. "Is he gone? Dear, dear!"
"But I didn't mean to say anything about it, for it's not birthday talk. But you've got it out of me, you see, before I sit down. I should have roused up in a minute,"
says the trooper, making himself speak more gaily.
"But you're so quick, Mrs. Bagnet."
"You're right. The old girl," says Mr. Bagnet, "is as quick as powder."
"And what's more, she's the subject of the day, and we'll stick to her,"
cries Mr. George.
"See here, I brought a little brooch along with me. It's a poor thing, you know, but it's a keepsake. That's all the good it is, Mrs. Bagnet."
Mr. George produces his present, which is greeted with admiring leapings and clappings by the young family, and with a species of reverential admiration by Mr. Bagnet.
"Old girl,"
says Mr. Bagnet,
"tell him my opinion of it."
"Why, it's a wonder, George," Mrs. Bagnet exclaims. "It's the beautifulest thing that ever was seen."
"Good,"
says Mr. Bagnet,
"my opinion."
"It's so pretty, George," cries Mrs. Bagnet, turning it on all sides and holding it out at arm's length, "that it seems too choice for me."
"Bad,"
says Mr. Bagnet.
"Not my opinion."
"But whatever it is, 100,000 thanks, old fellow," says Mrs. Bagnet, her eyes sparkling with pleasure and her hand stretched out to him. "And though I have been a cross-grained soldier's wife to you sometimes, George, we are as strong friends, I'm sure, in reality, as ever can be. Now you shall fasten it on yourself for good luck, if you will, George." The children close up to see it done, and Mr. Bagnet looks over young Woolwich's head to see it done with an interest so maturely wooden yet pleasantly childish that Mrs. Bagnet cannot help laughing in her airy way and saying, "Oh, Lignum, Lignum, what a precious old chap you are!" But the trooper fails to fasten the brooch. His hand shakes, he is nervous, and it falls off.
"Would anyone believe this?"
says he, catching it as it drops and looking round.
I'm so out of sorts that I bungle at an easy job like this.
Mrs. Bagnet concludes that for such a case there is no remedy like a pipe, and fastening the brooch herself in a twinkling, causes the trooper to be inducted into his usual snug place, and the pipes to be got into action. "If that don't bring you round, George," says she, "just throw your eye across here at your present now and then, and the two together must do it."
"You ought to do it of yourself," George answers. "I know that very well, Mrs. Bagnet. I'll tell you how, one way and another, the blues have got to be too many for me. Here was this poor lad. 'Twas dull work to see him dying as he did and not be able to help him."
"What do you mean, George? You did help him. You took him under your roof."
"I helped him so far, but that's little. I mean, Mrs. Bagnet, there he was, dying without ever having been taught much more than to know his right hand from his left, and he was too far gone to be helped out of that."
"Ah, poor creature," says Mrs. Bagnet.
"Then,"
says the trooper, not yet lighting his pipe and passing his heavy hand over his hair,
"that brought up Gridley in a man's mind. His was a bad case, too, in a different way. And then the two got mixed up in a man's mind with a flinty old rascal who had to do with both. And to think of that rusty carbine, stock and barrel standing up on end in his corner, hard, indifferent, taking everything so evenly. It made flesh and blood tingle, I do assure you."
"My advice to you," returns Mrs. Bagnet, "is to light your pipe and tingle that way. It's wholesomer and comfortabler, and better for the health altogether."
"You're right,"
says the trooper,
"and I'll do it."
So he does it, though still with an indignant gravity that impresses the young Bagnets, and even causes Mr. Bagnet to defer the ceremony of drinking Mrs. Bagnet's health, always given by himself on these occasions in a speech of exemplary terseness. But the young ladies having composed what Mr. Bagnet is in the habit of calling
the mixture,
and George's pipe being now in a glow, Mr. Bagnet considers it his duty to proceed to the toast of the evening. He addresses the assembled company in the following terms.
"George, Woolwich, Quebec, Malta, this is her birthday. Take a day's march, and you won't find such another. Here's towards her."
The toast having been drunk with enthusiasm, Mrs. Bagnet returns thanks in a neat address of corresponding brevity. This model composition is limited to the three words, "And wishing yours," which the old girl follows up with a nod at everybody in succession and a well-regulated swig of the mixture. This she again follows up, on the present occasion, by the wholly unexpected exclamation, "Here's a man!" Here is a man, much to the astonishment of the little company, looking in at the parlour door. He is a sharp-eyed man, a quick, keen man, and he takes in everybody's look at him all at once, individually and collectively, in a manner that stamps him a remarkable man. "George," says the man, nodding, "how do you find yourself?"
"Why, it's Bucket,"
cries Mr. George. "Yes," says the man, coming in and closing the door. "I was going down the street here when I happened to stop and look in at the musical instruments in the shop window. A friend of mine is in want of a second-hand violoncella, of a good tone. And I saw a party enjoying themselves, and I thought it was you in the corner. I thought I couldn't be mistaken. How goes the world with you, George, at the present moment? Pretty smooth? And with you, ma'am? And with you, Governor? And Lord," says Mr. Bucket, opening his arms, "here's children, too. You may do anything with me if you only show me children. Give us a kiss, my pets. No occasion to inquire who your father and mother is. Never saw such a likeness in my life." Mr. Bucket, not unwelcome, has sat himself down next to Mr. George and taken Quebec and Malta on his knees. "You pretty dears," says Mr. Bucket, "give us another kiss. It's the only thing I'm greedy in. Lord bless you, how healthy you look. And what may be the ages of these two, ma'am? I shall put them down at the figures of about 8 and 10. "You're very near, sir," says Mrs. Bagnet.
"I generally am near," returns Mr. Bucket, "being so fond of children. A friend of mine has had 19 of them, ma'am, all by one mother, and she's still as fresh and rosy as the morning. Not so much so as yourself, but upon my soul she comes near you. What do you call these, my darling?" pursues Mr. Bucket, pinching Malta's cheeks. "These are peaches, these are, bless your heart. What do you think about father? Do you think father could recommend a second-hand violoncello of a good tone for Mr. Bucket's friend, my dear? My name's Bucket. Ain't that a funny name?" These blandishments have entirely won the family heart. Mrs. Bagnet forgets the day to the extent of filling a pipe and a glass for Mr. Bucket, and waiting upon him hospitably.
She would be glad to receive so pleasant a character under any circumstances, but she tells him that as a friend of George's she is particularly glad to see him this evening, for George has not been in his usual spirits. "Not in his usual spirits?" exclaims Mr. Bucket. "Why, I never heard of such a thing. What's the matter, George? You don't intend to tell me you've been out of spirits? What should you be out of spirits for? You haven't got anything on your mind, you know."
"Nothing particular,"
returns the trooper. "I should think not," rejoins Mr. Bucket. "What could you have on your mind, you know? And have these pets got anything on their minds, eh? Not they. But they'll be upon the minds of some of the young fellows some of these days, and make 'em precious low-spirited. I ain't much of a prophet, but I can tell you that, ma'am." Mrs. Bagnet, quite charmed, hopes Mr. Bucket has a family of his own. "There, ma'am," says Mr. Bucket, "would you believe it? No, I haven't. My wife and a lodger constitute my family. Mrs. Bucket is as fond of children as myself, and as wishful to have 'em, but no. So it is. Worldly goods are divided unequally, and man must not repine. What a very nice backyard, ma'am. Any way out of that yard, now?" "There is no way out of that yard." "Ain't there really?" says Mr. Bucket. "I should have thought there might have been. Still, I don't know as I ever saw a backyard that took my fancy more. Would you allow me to look at it?" "Thank you. Now, I see there's no way out, but what a very good proportioned yard it is." Having cast his sharp eye all about it, Mr. Bucket returns to his chair next his friend Mr. George, and pats Mr. George affectionately on the shoulder. "How are your spirits now, George?"
"All right now,"
returns the trooper.
"That's your sort," says Mr. Bucket. "Why should you ever have been otherwise? A man of your fine figure and constitution has no right to be out of spirits. That ain't a chest to be out of spirits, is it, ma'am? And you haven't got anything on your mind, you know, George. What could you have on your mind?"
Somewhat harping on this phrase, considering the extent and variety of his conversational powers, Mr. Bucket twice or thrice repeats it to the pipe he lights, and with a listening face that is particularly his own. But the sun of his sociality soon recovers from this brief eclipse, and shines again. "And this is brother, is it, my dears?" says Mr. Bucket, referring to Quebec and Malta for information on the subject of young Woolwich. "And a nice brother he is. Half-brother, I mean to say, for he's too old to be your boy, ma'am."
"I can certify at all events that he's not anybody else's," returns Mrs. Bagnet, laughing.
"Well, you do surprise me. Yeah, he's like you, there's no denying. Lord, he's wonderfully like you. But about what you may call the brow, you know, there his father comes out."
Mr. Bucket compares the faces with one eye shut up, while Mr. Bagnet smokes in stolid satisfaction. This is an opportunity for Mrs. Bagnet to inform him that the boy is George's godson.
"George's godson, is he?" rejoins Mr. Bucket with extreme cordiality. "I must shake hands over again with George's godson. Godfather and godson do credit to one another. What do you intend to make of him, ma'am? Does he show any turn for any musical instrument?"
Mr. Bagnet suddenly interposes.
"Plays the fife, beautiful."
"Would you believe it, Governor," says Mr. Bucket, struck by the coincidence, "that when I was a boy, I played the fife myself. Not in a scientific way, as I expect he does, but by ear. Oh, bless you. British Grenadiers, there's a tune to warm an Englishman up. Could you give us British Grenadiers, my fine fellow?"
Nothing could be more acceptable to the little circle than this call upon young Woolwich, who immediately fetches his fife and performs the stirring melody, during which performance Mr. Bucket, much enlivened, beats time and never fails to come in sharp with a burden.
"British Grenadiers!"
In short, he shows so much musical taste that Mr. Bagnet actually takes his pipe from his lips to express his conviction that he is a singer. Mr. Bucket receives the harmonious impeachment so modestly, confessing how that he did once chaunt a little for the expression of the feelings of his own bosom, and with no presumptuous idea of entertaining his friends that he is asked to sing. Not to be behindhand in the sociality of the evening, he complies and gives them "Believe Me" of all those endearing young charms. This ballad, he informs Mrs. Bagnet, he considers to have been his most powerful ally in moving the heart of Mrs. Bucket when a maiden, and inducing her to approach the altar. Mr. Bucket's own words are, "to come up to the scratch." This sparkling stranger is such a new and agreeable feature in the evening that Mr. George, who testified no great emotions of pleasure on his entrance, begins, in spite of himself, to be rather proud of him. He is so friendly, is a man of so many resources, and so easy to get on with, that it is something to have made him known there.
Mr. Bagnet becomes, after another pipe, so sensible of the value of his acquaintance that he solicits the honour of his company on the old girl's next birthday. If anything can more closely cement and consolidate the esteem which Mr. Bucket has formed for the family, it is the discovery of the nature of the occasion. He drinks to Mrs. Bagnet with a warmth approaching to rapture, engages himself for that day, 12 months, more than thankfully, makes a memorandum of the day in a large black pocket-book with a girdle to it, and breathes a hope that Mrs. Bucket and Mrs. Bagnet may before then become, in a manner, sisters. As he says himself, what is public life without private ties? He is in his humble way a public man, but it is not in that sphere that he finds happiness. No, it must be sought within the confines of domestic bliss. It is natural, under these circumstances, that he, in his turn, should remember the friend to whom he is indebted for so promising an acquaintance. And he does. He keeps very close to him. Whatever the subject of the conversation, he keeps a tender eye upon him. He waits to walk home with him. He is interested in his very boots, and observes even them attentively as Mr. George sits, smoking, cross-legged in the chimney corner. At length, Mr. George rises to depart. At the same moment, Mr. Bucket, with a secret sympathy of friendship, also rises. He dotes upon the children to the last, and remembers the commission he has undertaken for an absent friend.
"Respecting that second-hand violoncello, Governor, could you recommend me such a thing?"
"Scores!" said Mr. Bagnet.
"I'm obliged to you," returns Mr. Bucket, squeezing his hand. "You're a friend in need. A good tone, mind you. My friend is a regular dab at it. Ecod, he saws away at Mozart and Handel and the rest of the bigwigs like a thorough workman. And you needn't," says Mr. Bucket in a considerate and private voice, "you needn't commit yourself to too low a figure, Governor. I don't want to pay too large a price for my friend, but I want you to have the proper percentage and be remunerated for your loss of time. That is but fair. Every man must live and ought to it." Mr. Bagnet shakes his head at the old girl to the effect that they have found a jewel of price. "Suppose I was to give you a look in, say, at 10:30 tomorrow morning. Perhaps you could name the figures of a few violoncellos of a good tone," says Mr. Bucket. Nothing easier. Mr. and Mrs. Bagnet both engage to have the requisite information ready, and even hint to each other at the practicability of having a small stock collected there for approval. "Thank you," says Mr. Bucket. "Thank you. Good night, ma'am. Good night, Governor. Good night, darlings. I'm much obliged to you for one of the pleasantest evenings I ever spent in my life." They, on the contrary, are much obliged to him for the pleasure he has given them in his company. And so they part, with many expressions of goodwill on both sides. "Now, George, old boy," says Mr. Bucket, taking his arm at the shop door, "come along." As they go down the little street, and the Bagnets pause for a minute, looking after them, Mrs. Bagnet remarks to the worthy Lignum that Mr. Bucket almost clings to George, like, and seems to be really fond of him. The neighbouring streets, being narrow and ill-paved, it is a little inconvenient to walk there two abreast and arm in arm. Mr. George therefore soon proposes to walk singly. But Mr. Bucket, who cannot make up his mind to relinquish his friendly hold, replies, "Wait half a minute, George. I should wish to speak to you first." Immediately afterwards he twists him into a public house, and into a parlour, where he confronts him, and claps his own back against the door. "Now, George," says Mr. Bucket, "duty is duty, and friendship is friendship. I never want the two to clash if I can help it. I have endeavoured to make things pleasant tonight, and I put it to you whether I have done it or not. You must consider yourself in custody, George."
"Custody? What for?"
returns the trooper, thunderstruck. "Now, George," says Mr. Bucket, urging a sensible view of the case upon him with his fat forefinger, "duty, as you know very well, is one thing, and conversation is another. It's my duty to inform you that any observations you may make will be liable to be used against you. Therefore, George, be careful what you say. You don't happen to have heard of a murder?"
"Murder?"
"Now, George," says Mr. Bucket, keeping his forefinger in an impressive state of action, "bear in mind what I've said to you. I ask you nothing. You've been in low spirits this afternoon. I say you don't happen to have heard of a murder."
"No. Where has there been a murder?"
"Now, George," says Mr. Bucket, "don't you go and commit yourself. I'm a-going to tell you what I want you for. There has been a murder in Lincoln's Inn Fields. Gentleman of the name of Tulkinghorn. He was shot last night. I want you for that." The trooper sinks upon a seat behind him, and great drops start out upon his forehead, and a deadly pallor overspreads his face.
"Bucket!" "'It's not possible that Mr. Tulkinghorn has been killed, and you suspect me?'
"'George,' returns Mr. Bucket, keeping his forefinger going, "'it is certainly possible because it's the case. "'This deed was done last night at 10 o'clock. "'Now you know where you were last night at 10 o'clock, "'and you'll be able to prove it, no doubt.'
"'Last night? Last night?'
repeats the trooper thoughtfully. "'Then it flashes upon him.
"'Why? Great heaven! I was there last night!'
"'So I have understood, George,' returns Mr. Bucket, with great deliberation. "'So I have understood. "'Likewise, you've been very often there. "'You've been seen hanging about the place, "'and you've been heard more than once in a wrangle with him, "'and it's possible—I don't say it's certainly so, mind you, but it's possible—' that he may have been heard to call you a threatening, murdering, dangerous fellow. The trooper gasps as if he would admit it all if he could speak. Now, George, continues Mr. Bucket, putting his hat upon the table with an air of business, rather in the upholstery way than otherwise, my wish is, as it has been all the evening, to make things pleasant. I'll tell you plainly, there's a reward out of 100 guineas offered by Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet. You and me have always been pleasant together, but I've got a duty to discharge, and if that 100 guineas is to be made, it may as well be made by me as any other man. On all of which accounts, I should hope it was clear to you that I must have you, and that I'm damned if I don't have you. Am I to call in any assistance, or is the trick done? Mr. George has recovered himself and stands up like a soldier.
Come,
he says.
I'm ready.
George, continues Mr. Bucket, wait a bit. With his upholsterer manner, as if the trooper were a window to be fitted up, he takes from his pocket a pair of handcuffs. This is a serious charge, George, and such is my duty. The trooper flushes angrily and hesitates a moment, but holds out his two hands clasped together and says,
There, put them on.
Mr. Bucket adjusts them in a moment. How do you find them? Are they comfortable? If not, say so, for I wish to make things as pleasant as is consistent with my duty, and I've got another pair in my pocket. This remark he offers like a most respectable tradesman, anxious to execute an order neatly, and to the perfect satisfaction of his customer. They'll do as they are? Very well. Now you see, George. He takes a cloak from a corner, and begins adjusting it about the trooper's neck. I was mindful of your feelings when I come out, and brought this on purpose. There. Who's the wiser?
Only I, returns the trooper. But as I know it, do me one more good turn and pull my hat over my eyes.
Really, though, do you mean it? Ain't it a pity? It looks so.
I can't look chance men in the face with these things on,
Mr. George hurriedly replies.
Do, for God's sake, pull my hat forward.
So strongly entreated, Mr. Bucket complies, puts his own hat on, and conducts his prize into the streets, the trooper marching on as steadily as usual, though with his head less erect, and Mr. Bucket steering him with his elbow over the crossings and up the turnings. Chapter 50. Esther's Narrative. It happened that when I came home from Deal, I found a note from Caddy Jellyby, as we always continued to call her, informing me that her health, which had been for some time very delicate, was worse, and that she would be more glad than she could tell me if I would go to see her. It was a note of a few lines, written from the couch on which she lay, and enclosed to me in another from her husband, in which he seconded her entreaty with much solicitude. Caddy was now the mother, and I the godmother, of such a poor little baby, such a tiny old-faced mite, with a countenance that seemed to be scarcely anything but cap-border, and a little lean, long-fingered hand always clenched under its chin. It would lie in this attitude all day, with its bright specks of eyes open, wondering, as I used to imagine, how it came to be so small and weak. Whenever it was moved, it cried, but at all other times it was so patient that the sole desire of its life appeared to be to lie quiet and think. It had curious little dark veins in its face, and curious little dark marks under its eyes, like faint remembrances of poor Caddy's inky days, and altogether, to those who were not used to it, it was quite a piteous little sight. But it was enough for Caddy that she was used to it. The projects with which she beguiled her illness, for little Esther's education and little Esther's marriage, and even for her own old age, as the grandmother of little Esther's little Esther's, was so prettily expressive of devotion to this pride of her life, that I should be tempted to recall some of them, but for the timely remembrance that I am getting on irregularly as it is. To return to the letter. Caddy had a superstition about me which had been strengthening in her mind ever since that night, long ago, when she had lain asleep with her head in my lap. She almost, I think I must say, quite believed that I did her good whenever I was near her. Now, although this was such a fancy of the affectionate girl's that I'm almost ashamed to mention it, still it might have all the force of a fact when she was really ill. Therefore I set off to Caddy with my guardian's consent post-haste, and she and Prince made so much of me that there never was anything like it. Next day I went again to sit with her, and next day I went again. It was a very easy journey, for I had only to rise a little earlier in the morning and keep my accounts and attend to housekeeping matters before leaving home. But when I had made these three visits, my guardian said to me on my return at night,
"Now, little woman, this will never do. Constant dropping will wear away a stone, and constant coaching will wear out a Dame Durden. We will go to London for a while and take possession of our old lodgings."
"Not for me, dear guardian," said I, "for I never feel tired." Which was strictly true. I was only too happy to be in such request.
"For me, then," returned my guardian, "or for Ada, or for both of us. It is somebody's birthday tomorrow, I think."
"Truly, I think it is," said I, kissing my darling, who would be 21 tomorrow.
"Well," observed my guardian, half pleasantly, half seriously, "that's a great occasion, and will give my fair cousin some necessary business to transact in assertion of her independence, and will make London a more convenient place for all of us. So, to London we will go. That being settled, there is another thing. How have you left Caddy?"
"Very unwell, guardian. I fear it will be some time before she regains her health and strength."
"What do you call some time now?" asked my guardian thoughtfully.
"Some weeks, I'm afraid."
"Ah."
He began to walk about the room with his hands in his pockets, showing that he had been thinking as much.
"Now, what do you say about her doctor? Is he a good doctor, my love?"
I felt obliged to confess that I knew nothing to the contrary, but that Prince and I had agreed only that evening that we would like his opinion to be confirmed by someone.
"Well, you know," returned my guardian quickly, "there's Woodcourt."
I had not meant that, and was rather taken by surprise. For a moment all that I had had in my mind in connection with Mr. Woodcourt seemed to come back and confuse me.
"You don't object to him, little woman?"
"Object to him, guardian? Oh, no."
"And you don't think the patient would object to him?"
"So far from that, I had no doubt of her being prepared to have a great reliance on him and to like him very much. I said that he was no stranger to her personally, for she had seen him often in his kind attendance on Miss Flight.
"Very good," said my guardian. "He has been here today, my dear, and I will see him about it tomorrow."
I felt in this short conversation, though I did not know how, for she was quiet, and we interchanged no look, that my dear girl well remembered how merrily she had clasped me round the waist when no other hands than Caddy's had brought me the little parting token. This caused me to feel that I ought to tell her and Caddy too that I was going to be the mistress of Bleak House, and that if I avoided that disclosure any longer, I might become less worthy in my own eyes of its master's love. Therefore, when we went upstairs and had waited listening until the clock struck 12, in order that only I might be the first to wish my darling all good wishes on her birthday, and to take her to my heart, I set before her, just as I had set before myself, the goodness and honour of her cousin John, and the happy life that was in store for me. If ever my darling were fonder of me at one time than another in all our intercourse, she was surely fondest of me that night. And I was so rejoiced to know it, and so comforted by the sense of having done right in casting this last idle reservation away, that I was 10 times happier than I had been before. I had scarcely thought it a reservation a few hours ago, but now that it was gone, I felt as if I understood its nature better. Next day we went to London. We found our old lodging vacant, and in half an hour were quietly established there, as if we had never gone away. Mr. Woodcourt dined with us to celebrate my darling's birthday, and we were as pleasant as we could be with the great blank among us that Richard's absence naturally made on such an occasion. After that day, I was for some weeks, 8 or 9 as I remember, very much with Caddy, and thus it fell out that I saw less of Ada at this time than any other since we had first come together, except the time of my own illness. She often came to Caddy's, but our function there was to amuse and cheer her, and we did not talk in our usual confidential manner. Whenever I went home at night, we were together, but Caddy's rest was broken by pain, and I often remained to nurse her. With her husband and her poor little mite of a baby to love, and their home to strive for, what a good creature Caddy was! So self-denying, so uncomplaining, so anxious to get well on their account, so afraid of giving trouble, and so thoughtful of the unassisted labours of her husband and the comforts of old Mr. Turveydrop. I had never known the best of her until now, and it seemed so curious that her pale face and helpless figure should be lying there day after day where dancing was the business of life, where the kit and the apprentices began early every morning in the ballroom, and where the untidy little boy waltzed by himself in the kitchen all the afternoon. At Caddy's request, I took the supreme direction of her apartment, trimmed it up, and pushed her, couch and all, into a lighter and more airy and more cheerful corner than she had yet occupied. Then every day, when we were in our neatest array, I used to lay my small, small namesake in her arms, and sit down to chat, or work, or read to her. It was at one of the first of these quiet times that I told Caddy about Bleak House. We had other visitors, besides Ada. First of all, we had Prince, who in his hurried intervals of teaching used to come softly in and sit softly down, with a face of loving anxiety for Caddy and the very little child. Whatever Caddy's condition really was, she never failed to declare to Prince that she was all but well, which I, heaven forgive me, never failed to confirm. This would put Prince in such good spirits that he would sometimes take the kit from his pocket and play a chord or two to astonish the baby, which I never knew it to do in the least degree, for my tiny namesake never noticed it at all. Then there was Mrs. Jellyby. She would come, occasionally, with her usual distraught manner, and sit calmly looking miles beyond her grandchild, as if her attention were absorbed by a young Borrioboolan on its native shores. As bright-eyed as ever, as serene and as untidy, she would say, "Well, Caddy child, and how do you do today?" and then would sit amiably smiling and taking no notice of the reply, or would sweetly glide off into a calculation of the number of letters she had lately received and answered, or of the coffee-bearing power of Borrioboolagar. This she would always do with a serene contempt for our limited sphere of action, not to be disguised. Then there was old Mr. Turveydrop, who was from morning to night and from night to morning the subject of innumerable precautions. If the baby cried, it was nearly stifled, lest the noise should make him uncomfortable. If the fire wanted stirring in the night, it was surreptitiously done, lest his rest should be broken. If Caddy required any little comfort that the house contained, she first carefully discussed whether he was likely to require it too. In return for this consideration, he would come into the room once a day, all but blessing it, showing a condescension and a patronage, and a grace of manner in dispensing the light of his high-shouldered presence from which I might have supposed him, if I had not known better, to have been the benefactor of Caddy's life.
"My Caroline,"
he would say, making the nearest approach that he could to bending over her,
"tell me that you are better to-day."
"Oh, much better, thank you, Mr. Turveydrop," Caddy would reply.
"Delighted, enchanted. And our dear Miss Summerson, she is not quite prostrated by fatigue?"
Here he would crease up his eyelids and kiss his fingers to me, though I am happy to say he had ceased to be particular in his attentions since I had been so altered. "Not at all," I would assure him.
"Charming. We must take care of our dear Caroline, Miss Summerson. We must spare nothing that will restore her. We must nourish her. My dear Caroline," he would turn to his daughter-in-law with infinite generosity and protection, "want for nothing, my love. Frame a wish and gratify it, my daughter. Everything this house contains, everything my room contains, is at your service, my dear. Do not," he would sometimes add, in a burst of deportment, "even allow my simple requirements to be considered if they should at any time interfere with your own, my Caroline. Your necessities are greater than mine."
He had established such a long prescriptive right to this deportment, his son's inheritance from his mother, that I several times knew both Caddy and her husband to be melted to tears by these affectionate self-sacrifices.
"Nay, my dears,"
he would remonstrate, and when I saw Caddy's thin arm about his fat neck as he said it, I would be melted too, though not by the same process.
"Nay, nay, I have promised never to leave ye. Be dutiful and affectionate towards me, and I ask no other return. Now, bless ye, I'm going to the park."
He would take the air there presently, and get an appetite for his hotel dinner. I hope I do old Mr. Turveydrop no wrong, but I never saw any better traits in him than these I faithfully record, except that he certainly conceived a liking for Peepy,
and would take the child out walking with great pomp, always on those occasions sending him home before he went to dinner himself, and occasionally with a halfpenny in his pocket. But even this disinterestedness was attended with no inconsiderable cost to my knowledge, for before Peepy was sufficiently decorated to walk hand in hand with a professor of deportment, he had to be newly dressed, at the expense of Caddy and her husband, from top to toe. Last of our visitors, there was Mr. Jellyby. Really, when he used to come in of an evening and ask Caddy in his meek voice how she was, and then sit down with his head against the wall and make no attempt to say anything more, I liked him very much. If he found me bustling about doing any little thing, he sometimes half took his coat off, as if with an intention of helping by a great exertion. But he never got any further. His sole occupation was to sit with his head against the wall, looking hard at the thoughtful baby. And I could not quite divest my mind of a fancy that they understood one another. I have not counted Mr. Woodcourt among our visitors, because he was now Caddy's regular attendant. She soon began to improve under his care, but he was so gentle, so skilful, so unwearying in the pains he took, that it was not to be wondered at, I am sure. I saw a good deal of Mr. Woodcourt during this time,